This is Steve Sherlock with another internet radio show, or podcast, number 183 in the series for Franklin Matters. This recording shares the parent information session on adolescent sleep held in the Franklin High School Lecture Hall on Tuesday, November 19, 2019. Dr. Sarah Hearn, school superintendent for Franklin Public Schools, provided the welcome to the group and introduced Dr. Judith Owens, who presented The Universe of Adolescent Sleep. As Dr. Owens finished her slide presentation and talk, Superintendent Hearn facilitated questions from the audience. Panther TV did also record the session, and it will be readied for sharing. When the video is available, we'll share that link. The recording of the discussion runs approximately 92 minutes. Be sure to follow through to the show notes where Dr. Owens' presentation can be found so you can follow along with her. And without further ado, here is the session on adolescent sleep.
Thanks so much for coming, everybody. We'll get started. Folks may join as the night continues. The doors will be open downstairs until about 7 to allow people to come in. I'm Sarah Ahern. I'm the superintendent of schools here in Franklin, the proud superintendent of schools here in Franklin. And I'm really happy that you're here to join us to learn more about sleep research as part of our parent education series. I do want to make a couple of introductions. I want to note that the chair of our school committee, Dr. Ann Bergen, is here. We also have Tim Keenan, member of our school committee here. A former member of our school committee, Monica Linden, is here. And we're joined by a couple of administrators, Miriam Goodman, school business administrator, and Paul Dupre, middle school principal, are here as well, along with a number of critical stakeholders in our community, very familiar faces from previous meetings, the CERT Times Advisory Committee, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you for joining us for part of this education series. We're really happy to be able to share this with you as community members, and families, and we kind of hung a sign on the issue of sleep and sleep deprivation for children last year, and we want to make sure that we are attending to our own knowledge and background on that. A number of things came to light. One was the idea and the prospect of start times, which we have kind of deferred for this year to focus on some other priorities that we've determined. But we also want to recognize and acknowledge that sleep deprivation has its consequences. So this is part of a series of educational efforts to families. We had a social media night in October. We actually just released a podcast with about a 20-minute segment that summarized the social media event and points families towards resources, knowing that social media can get in the way of many things, but sleep being one of them. We have tonight some background information on sleep research. We have a parent education night coming up in the spring on homework. Also, kind of one of the issues that came to light in the community conversation was about students and homework. We have new homework guidelines in our school handbooks this year, all with an effort towards healthier children, which I also want to take a moment to plug a vaping presentation, which will be coming to families on January 6th as part of a series for both students, teachers, and families to learn more about the dangers and what we can do to combat vaping. So tonight we're going to hear from Dr. Owens, who's here. We're thrilled to have her. She'll be doing a presentation for about 45 minutes, and then we'll engage in some Q&A. Want to make sure that everybody feels comfortable in the environment asking questions, and so we're going to use a structure for that, which we've used in the past, and one that Dr. Owens has also used and suggested. So I've got some note cards and pencils, and if you could jot your questions down, we will collect those and ask them of Dr. Owens at the conclusion of her introductory remarks. So with that, I want to make sure that I introduce Dr. Owens, who is here. She is the director of Center for Pediatric Sleep Disorders at Boston Children's Hospital, and she is also a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. She speaks to many communities on this topic, and we're really pleased that she is joining us here tonight. And so, Dr. Arntz, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and really thank you all for taking time out of your busy lives to share an hour or so with me. I really appreciate that, the privilege of being able to speak with you about a topic that has been near and dear to my heart for quite some time. My background is in developmental behavioral pediatrics and child psychiatry. And in the old days when I trained, nobody talked about sleep. That wasn't part of our medical education. What we've learned since then, it's been 40 years almost since I graduated from medical school, is really astounding. And our understanding of sleep and the function of sleep and the sleep development, particularly during the adolescent years, and also what the consequences are of not getting adequate sleep, I think is really been a revolution in terms of helping us understand the importance of sleep. And so I hope to really to convey that to you. That's my main message here, is that this is something that is absolutely critical to health and well-being and safety and school performance and just about everything that you can think of. Oops. Let's see. Sorry.
Space bar?
Sorry about that.
It wasn't just me.
Huh. I don't know. So you can just tap that.
Just tap that. Okay. So here's what we're going to cover. First of all, I really want to talk about what normal sleep development looks like in adolescence, and what are some of the recommendations for achieving sleep health. And some of this work has been done by my dear colleague at Brown Medical School, Dr. Mary Karskaden, who really was a pioneer in helping us to understand the biology of sleep in adolescence. And then I want to start, I want to talk about the neurocognitive, the health, safety consequences of what I call deficient sleep, and I will define that in a little bit, in adolescence. I'm not going to really talk about sleep disorders per se, except the disorder of insufficient sleep, if you will, which is really has become an epidemic, and not only in our country, but really around the world. And then I will talk some about the data supporting healthy school start times as a potential intervention to address this real public health crisis that we have in this country of chronic sleep deprivation. So if you'll indulge me, I think it's important to kind of understand a few really basic constructs about sleep that I think many of us don't appreciate because we've never been taught. But nonetheless, I think it's really critically important to understand some of these concepts, particularly as it relates to what happens to sleep in the teenage years. So this is what's called the two-process model of sleep regulation. And it's a bit simplistic, but I think it's a pretty accurate representation of what determines how sleepy or awake we are at any given time during the 24-hour day. So the first process we talk about is the sleep drive. And we think that that's based on the accumulation of certain neurotransmitters in the brain that build up while we're awake. And these are called somnogens, somno meaning sleep promoting. And these substances, these neurochemicals, build up in our brains over the course of being awake during the day. And so what that shows the upper trajectory, the arrows here. So the sleep drive builds in a fairly linear fashion throughout the course of the day. The longer we're awake, the stronger the sleep drive. And the sleep drive is also dependent to a certain extent on how much sleep we've gotten the night before and the night before that, and the quality of the sleep. But essentially, it is parallel to the amount of time that we're awake. And so when we get a good night's sleep, that sleep drive is dissipated over the course of the night. And hopefully we wake up in the morning without a high sleep drive. Now, sometimes adding to that and sometimes in opposition to that is what we call the circadian drive towards wakefulness. This the biomarker of this is a hormone called melatonin, which is produced by a small gland at the base of our brain. And the circadian drive essentially is a fairly predictable pattern of relative peaks and troughs of alertness and sleepiness throughout the course of the day. So when we wake up in the morning, our circadian drive towards alertness is fairly low, but our sleep drive hopefully is low as well, so we feel pretty awake. And then we have sort of a bump in our circadian alertness around noontime, early afternoon, and then a dip between 3 and 5 in the afternoon, siesta time. That's when we tend to reach for a cup of coffee because we feel a little bit biologically sleepy at that time of day. But then there's something called the forbidden zone or the second wind phenomenon, which is a surge in circadian-based alertness that occurs in the hour or so before our bodies are ready to fall asleep. And that kind of offsets this accumulating sleep drive, so it allows us to stay awake a little bit longer. And then there is a more profound dip, the lowest level of circadian alertness in the 24-hour day, which occurs somewhere between 3 and 5 a.m., when most of us are asleep, so we don't perceive that. Now, I want you to imagine this whole graph moving about 2 hours later, and then we'll start talking about what happens in adolescence. I want to make a couple of other points. You know, we think a lot about how much sleep we get, but in fact, both sleep time and sleep timing are biological imperatives. They're both incredibly important. Because in addition to a master clock in our brains, each cell in the body contains a circadian oscillator or clock. Now you may recall that 2 years ago, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was won by several scientists who discovered this, that there are circadian clocks in every cell in the body and in every organ system in the body, which must be synchronized not only with each other, but with the environment. And misalignment between these internal circadian clocks and the environment, particularly the light-dark cycle, because as you may recall, darkness helps to turn melatonin on in the evening and light helps to turn it off in the morning. So this misalignment can result in profound impairments in physiologic function and health. So what is deficient sleep? So this is a concept that acknowledges that both short sleep duration, and that's in comparison to our sleep needs. And our sleep needs change as we age, and are quite dramatically different, in, for example, in a two-year-old versus an eight-year-old versus a 16-year-old versus a 72-year-old. And there is some variability in individual sleep needs, which we don't quite understand what drives that. But nonetheless, short sleep compared to sleep needs and circadian misalignment, which is this mismatch between the biological circadian rhythms and environmental demands, while interrelated, both contribute to the behavioral and cognitive impairments and poor health outcomes related to sleep. In other words, it's not just how much you sleep, it's when you sleep that's absolutely critical. And that latter piece is very important to understand, particularly when we start talking about adolescent sleep. So, in many ways, what goes on with sleep during the teenage years is a perfect storm. So first, all adolescents experience a normal shift or delay in circadian rhythms that particularly is linked to the onset of puberty, that leads to what we call an eveningness chronotype, or a tendency to be a night owl, as opposed to a morning lark, which younger children tend to be. They tend to go to bed earlier and wake up earlier because they have more of a morningness preference. And this understanding that we have of this biological shift comes from very rigorous studies that were done in sleep labs under controlled conditions, examining biological markers of sleep and puberty in adolescents. So this is really important science that has been around for quite a while now in terms of our understanding. So this results in a biologically based shift or delay of up to several hours, not only in the natural fall asleep time compared to younger children, but the morning wake time as well. And there are also some changes that occur during adolescence that in the sleep drive, so the accumulation of the sleep drive across the day slows in adolescence. So that makes it easier for them to stay up later. So you have these alterations both in the circadian system and the homeostatic sleep drive system. So on a practical level, due to these factors, as well as that forbidden zone, that bump in circadian alertness, it's very difficult for the average adolescent to fall asleep much before 11 p.m. on a regular basis. So for example, in order for high school students in Franklin at the current start time to obtain the recommended amount of sleep, which is between 8 and 10 hours, and so I picked 9 as sort of the middle ground, they would need to fall asleep by 9:30 in order to get up at 6:30 to get to school by 7:30. Is that going to happen?
No.
No. And teens cannot make themselves fall asleep earlier. It's not bad parenting, it's not poor limit setting, it's not stubborn teenagers, it's biology. Of course, I don't in any way discount all those other competing priorities for sleep, like homework, like after-school activities, like jobs, after-school jobs, social networking. And we know that this circadian delay that occurs during adolescence can be further exacerbated by evening light exposure, meaning between dusk and bedtime, because as I mentioned before, light suppresses the body's release of melatonin in the evening. And so here's where this perfect storm comes in. Adolescents starting at puberty are even more sensitive to this evening light than they were when they were younger children. And in particular, it's the blue light from screens, TVs, computer, laptop, even e-readers. One of my colleagues at Harvard, Dr. Chuck Seisler, did a study looking at e-readers. And not all of them, but a number of them also have that same melatonin-suppressing effect. And then the consumption of caffeine and other stimulants. So a substantial percentage of adolescents use energy drinks. You go in any convenience store and you can buy, on the one hand, you can buy the stuff that peps you up during the day, and then you can buy the stuff with melatonin that helps you sleep during the night. So you can medicate yourself 24 hours a day if you want to, just by going to 7-Eleven. And daytime sleepiness is a major driver for adolescents to consume caffeine. And there's some interesting information to suggest that caffeine may actually function as what we call a gateway drug. So that if you start using caffeine earlier and you use more caffeine, those adolescents are more likely to then use alcohol, to then use other controlled substances. Interesting, and I think we need to understand more about that relationship between caffeine and subsequent risky behaviors. However, in one of our studies, we actually looked at this issue of whether use of these light-emitting electronic devices like television, computer, smartphones, as reported by students, in bed before falling asleep, modified the effect of changing school start times in high school students. So what we found was that at baseline, before the school start time change, the adolescents who were using these light-emitting devices before bed had a shorter school night sleep duration because they fell asleep later. So clearly these devices had an impact on sleep. However, the impact of the school start time change on sleep duration was similar between those who did and did not use such devices in bed before falling asleep, suggesting that the practice of using these electronic devices doesn't appear to alter the potential benefit impacts of on sleep of a delay in school start time. So in other words, this is a very important piece to pay attention to, but it doesn't significantly reduce the impact of other interventions such as delaying school start times. So what do adolescents do when they chronically don't get enough sleep? They sleep in later on the weekends, right? So make up sleep. Important basic piece of information. If you sleep longer when you're given the opportunity, that means you're not getting enough sleep. Really simple equation. So that this weekend oversleep practice is really a marker of chronic insufficient sleep, but doesn't reverse or compensate for these impairments. You can't make up, it's not like a bank. You can't make up sleep. So this has led to a phenomenon which we actually call social jet lag. So there is oftentimes a shift in bedtime and wake times on non-school days that leads to further circadian misalignment. And this exacerbates that shift, that later circadian-based shift, and they've actually shown that melatonin release becomes later with this practice. And then if you don't wake up till noon or one on Sunday afternoon, There's no way you're going to build your sleep drive up enough to fall asleep at a reasonable time come Sunday night. And so this results in the semi-permanent state of jet lag. And if you've experienced jet lag, you may know that it takes one day per time zone crossed to adjust. So if you have a teen who's shifting 3 hours later and then has to shift 3 hours back, by the time they readjust, the whole process starts all over again. So even though on the surface of it, it seems like it would make sense to let them sleep all day on the weekends, that really doesn't accomplish anything. And in fact, it may add further to the situation. So the bottom line is these changes are in direct conflict with earlier high school start times, before 8:30. Because as a result of early start times, students are required to wake for the day and function during that circadian trough. Remember that occurring between 3 to 5 in the morning? Well, that shifts later too. And so these students are required to get up at the time of the lowest level of alertness during the 24-hour day. Mary Karskadden calls it, their bodies are up, but their brains are on the pillow, asleep. Not only that, but what's called REM, or rapid eye movement sleep, is concentrated in the last third of the night, otherwise known as dream sleep. And if you have to wake up too early, that selectively robs you of REM sleep. And why is that important? Because REM sleep is absolutely critical for learning of new information in particular. So they have done experimental studies where if you learn a new task and you have a period of REM sleep after learning that task, you are going to have much better memory of that, of learning how to do that. And so, as a result of all this, these teens are not able to meet their sleep needs. Because for optimal health, safety, and achievement, the average middle and high school student needs 8 to 10 hours of sleep. And that's a recommendation from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which did an extensive review over more than a year of all of the literature on adolescent sleep. So what are the consequences of all this? Well, we know, and we're beginning to understand more and more about this, that sleep has what we call a neuroprotective role. So that insufficient sleep, mistimed sleep, prolonged wakefulness affects neuronal functions in the brain, including something called neuronal plasticity, which is the ability of the brain to change structure and function in response to environmental demands. It affects gene activation and expression, the development of new nerve cells in the brain. It helps the brain protect itself from injury and stress and to repair itself. And the highest susceptibility are during critical developmental periods like adolescence. And furthermore, very exciting recent research has found evidence of what's called a glymphatic system, which essentially eliminates toxins that accumulate in the brain during the day. It eliminates these toxins during sleep and allows the brain to have a clean slate from which to work. And we're beginning to understand that this glymphatic system, or this ability of the brain to rid itself of these toxins only during sleep, may have implications for things like Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases. So sleep is absolutely critical to brain function in the short term and potentially for many, many years in the future. sleep and what's called behavioral self-regulation. So there are studies in which individuals, healthy individuals, volunteers are brought into the sleep lab and they have their sleep restricted. So, you know, they may sleep, they be allowed to only sleep 4 hours a night. And then they have what's called functional neuroimaging done, which takes pictures of their brain and actually shows how the brain is functioning and what areas of the brain are functioning. And we know that experimentally induced sleep restriction has selective effects on the prefrontal cortex and what are called executive functions. What are these? These are higher level cognitive functions, things like decision making, problem solving, flexibility, planning, judgment, motivation, monitoring, and modifying your behavior according to anticipated consequences, modulation of emotions. And guess what? The most rapid period of development of executive functions is during adolescence. So at a time when these skills, these brain functions are developing, we're hitting these students with something that is going to interrupt those functions. Emotional regulation. So similarly, there have been numerous experiments done in which individuals are brought into the sleep lab, sleep restricted. There's functional neuroimaging done. And for example, they may be shown disturbing images. And so they look at what happens in the brain under conditions in which the individual has been sleep restricted. And what they see is there's an increased uptake in what we call the emotional brain or the amygdala under conditions of sleep loss. Furthermore, there's a weaker connectivity between the emotional brain and the prefrontal cortex, these executive functions, which results in a heightened emotional response with less control over that response. You know, I think we like to talk about teenage behavior and hormones and, you know, that sort of thing and theatrics and dramatics, and but some of that may be due to chronic sleep loss. Risk-taking behaviors. So again, there are selective areas of the brain, particularly the striatum, which are important for what we call reward-related functions. So this is your response to an anticipated consequence or reward. And this part of the brain is also undergoing important structural and functional changes during the teen years. And studies suggest that insufficient sleep is linked to changes in what's called reward-related decision-making. So in other words, people under conditions of sleep loss take more risks because they perceive less in the way of consequences of taking those risks. And risk-taking behavior is an incredibly important issue during adolescence. And may I remind you that the first and third leading cause of death in adolescence are accidental injuries, which include car accidents, and unfortunately, third is suicide. So how does that relate to sleep? Well, in one study, in a large sample of high school students with more than 10,000 students surveyed, about 40% reported insufficient sleep. And what's particularly important, and this is very common in other similar studies, is the higher in grade the students are, the less sleep they get. So in this study, 20% of 8th graders, 42% of 10th graders, 56% of 12th graders were getting less than or equal to 6 hours of sleep. And only 10% overall were getting optimal sleep. And by 12th grade, only 3% of the students reported getting the amount of sleep that they need. Well, in the same study, 40% of the teens who reported getting 6 hours or less of sleep reported symptoms of depression. And this is the finding that we see over and over and over again. In addition to that, almost three times as many students who were getting less than 6 hours of sleep reported using alcohol in the past 30 days compared to those who were getting an adequate amount of sleep. So this has real world consequences. Real world consequences. Drowsy driving. So unfortunately, we know that 2/3 of accidental injury fatalities in adolescents are related to car crashes. And there have been a number of studies that have looked at this issue, including a AAA study in 2015 that found that 16% of 16 to 18-year-olds reported driving while so tired you had a hard time keeping your eyes open at least once in the past 30 days. In a study we recently published, almost 50% of adolescent drivers that we surveyed reported drowsy driving. And every hour less sleep on school nights compared to a sleep duration of at least 8 hours was associated with an increased risk of reporting drowsy driving. And you can see that the time of day of adolescent crashes is driving themselves to school in the morning and driving themselves back home in the afternoon, not in the late evening and late at night, as you might expect. And furthermore, this was a study of more than 50,000 high school students, and they looked at injury risk behaviors. So they looked at students who were getting less than 7 hours versus those who were getting 9 hours. And they were less likely to use bicycle helmets. They were less likely to use seat belts. They were more likely to text while driving. They were more likely to make a bad decision and drive with a drinking driver, and to drink and drive themselves. So it's not just, you know, the reaction time and the vigilance when you're driving a car, but it's making very poor decisions about other kinds of safety-related behaviors that further magnify the effect of insufficient sleep. So what about school start times? What do we know? Back in 2014, I was fortunate enough to be the lead author of the American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement that recommended school start time delay until 8:30 or later. Now, I promise you that this was an extremely rigorous process. It took about 4 years to get this policy statement put together. Because the American Academy of Pediatrics, as the premier champion of health in children and adolescents in the United States, is a very conservative organization, and they wanted to make sure they got it right. And when we originally looked at this issue back in the early 2000s, we decided there wasn't enough evidence at that time to make a recommendation like this. But when we revisited this about 10 years later, with the accumulation of data and evidence that's out there, the American Academy of Pediatrics felt that it was time to take a stand. And this has also been endorsed by the American Medical Association, the Centers for Disease Control, the American Psychological Association, the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Organization, American Thoracic Society, the National Educational Association, National PTA. I mean, there's a whole host of organizations that have come to agree that this is in the best interest of the health and well-being of students. So I'll share a little bit with you. I mean, there's a lot of evidence here, but I will try to summarize that. So in terms of student self-reported data, and this was a study that was published in 2016, so there have been a number of additional studies published since then. But essentially, they saw later wake times. There were reports of both somewhat later bedtimes and in some cases earlier bedtimes associated with the delay in school start times. Virtually universally, students slept more. They had less of this weekend catch-up sleep. They reported less daytime sleepiness, more satisfaction with their sleep, less depressed mood, more time doing homework. The depressed mood, less depressed mood, has shown up over and over and over again in virtually every study that has looked at that. So again, bedtimes remained similar, maybe were delayed by typically 10 minutes or so after the start time change when they shifted later, but this was offset by sleeping significantly later in the morning. So students obtained more sleep, particularly that critical morning sleep that I mentioned before, which is so important for memory consolidation. And the later the start time, the greater the sleep amounts that students reported getting, less daytime sleepiness. And so it has emerged that this 8:30 or later seems to be sort of the sleep and circadian sweet spot in terms of addressing not only getting these students more sleep, but getting them sleep when at the time that they need it and can benefit from it the most. And this is an amalgam of data from Kyla Wahlstrom's 2014 study, and it just kind of illustrates essentially the later the start time, the greater the percentage of students who are getting at least 8 hours on a school night. And when you talk about when school starts in Franklin, 34% of those students are getting at least 8 hours of sleep, compared to 60% at 8:35, and even higher, 2/3 of the students at 8:55. School performance. I think grades are hard to see differences in, because grades are impacted upon by so many different variables. And it's really hard to find, to make an equivalency between what's the grades that students get before start time change and then after start time change. But nonetheless, there have been studies which have shown, particularly first period class grades improve, as you might imagine. Some have shown an increase in grade point average. Some have shown higher standardized test scores. But those are also tricky because it's really hard to compare standardized test scores across districts because different percentages of students take these standardized tests depending on the district. So it's that is also something that's more challenging to compare. But other areas that are related to school success have been shown to improve, like increased attendance, decrease in absenteeism, decreases in tardiness. One study even showing a decrease in dropout rates and increased graduation rates associated with changes in school start times. In addition, delayed school start times have been associated with improvements in mood, as I mentioned, health, like decreased visits to the health center, and safety. And I think this, to me, this is the most compelling data. In a number of studies now, in a school district in Kentucky, this was published more than 10 years ago, when they changed the start time from 7:30 to 8:40, the percent of teens involved in car crashes went down by 16% versus an increase 9% in the rest of the state. In Virginia, they compared two different adjacent communities, which are very similar sociodemographically. One started at 7:20, the other at 8:40, and the earlier starting district had the car crashes in adolescents were 40% higher. And some of Kyla Wahlstrom's work has suggested that reduction in car crashes in 16 to 18-year-olds maybe as much as 65% to 70% in some of the areas that she looked at, which as a public health person, it's hard for me to imagine something that would have that big an impact on what is essentially the major cause of mortality in adolescents. And we have a study that is in press right now, in which we looked at the impact of a 50-minute delay in high school start times from 7:20 to 8:10 on driving safety, and we analyzed DMV, database car crash rates, in 16 to 18-year-olds during the two-year period before and after start time change. This is in Fairfax County, Virginia, which is the 11th largest school district in the country, 183,000 students, 27 high schools. And we found that there was a significant decrease in crash rates in Fairfax County and a slight increase, although this wasn't significant, from baseline in the rest of Virginia, and this amounted to approximately 126 fewer crashes after the start time change. And in particular, because they don't categorize drowsy driving related crashes as a separate entity, what we found though was that distraction related crashes in particular declined, which makes sense when you think about the poor decisions that these students are more likely to make. And there was a very interesting study that came out fairly recently in 2017 by the RAND Corporation, and they used macroeconomic modeling of what would happen if there was a state, for each state, if there was a statewide change from whatever the current start time was to 8:30 or later versus the status quo, that found that the benefits of later start times far outweighed the immediate costs. And they were fairly generous in assigning costs, saying that $150 per student per year to change start times, plus a basic $110,000 cost for infrastructure. And so based on projected student lifetime earnings that was related to increased high school graduation rates and more likely to attend university, and in this study they factored in that reduction in car crash piece. And so during the 15-year period that the study examined, should each state change to 8:30 or later, if they took all, then they looked at 47 states across the country, the average annual gain to the U.S. economy would be $9.3 billion per year, which is the approximate annual revenue of Major League Baseball, if you want some standard of comparison. And some states, including Massachusetts, would break even after 2 years. And so this study really suggested that delaying school start times to 8:30 or later is a cost-effective population-level strategy that could have a significant effect on public health and the U.S. economy. Now, you may be aware that as of October 13th, California's Senate Bill 348 went into law, was signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom. And this bill stipulates that public high schools we will begin no earlier than 8:30 and middle schools no earlier than 8 a.m. and that statewide implementation is mandated by the academic year 2022-23, which gives school districts a three-year period to make these adjustments. This is enormous. California is the largest public school system in the country. And the first time this bill was approved by the Senate, it was vetoed by outgoing Governor Jerry Brown. And there was enormous pushback, particularly from the teachers' unions in California. And I was very involved in this process. And I still pinch myself that this bill actually was passed. And I think it just is an enormous milestone in this effort. Now, of course, we need to see what happens. And I think one of the big issues will be what happens to elementary school start times. Because one of the strategies that schools, districts employ is what's called a flip, where essentially they exchange the high school start time with the elementary school start times. And you may be aware that this issue was what derailed the Boston schools from public schools from changing their high school start times. So it's an issue that we need to pay a lot of attention to, and that schools really need to be thoughtful about, because understandably, elementary school parents can become very concerned about this. And so, you know, what exactly the optimal start time is for elementary school students, honestly, we don't know. I think we have some thoughts about that that have to do with our understanding of circadian rhythms and younger children and their sleep needs. And this is something that we need more evidence about. We have the evidence about high school students and middle school students. We have it. It's irrefutable. We don't have it, I will absolutely fully admit, about elementary school students, and we need to get it. So what can schools do? Set healthy school start times, I think, number one. I think we also need to provide sleep health education. And it shouldn't start in high school. It should start in kindergarten. But I think part of the reason we don't always see the biggest bang for the buck in changing school start times is we don't do enough education of parents and students about the importance of sleep and getting to bed on time and doing the things that they need to do to get enough sleep. The other issue that I would raise, and this was something that I really think we found when we looked at Fairfax County. So I was involved in studying the impact of, in Fairfax County, Virginia, looking at the change in start time. This was from 7:20 to 8:10. And we didn't see as many positive benefits in some areas that we would have liked. I think that's because of the 8:30 really seems to be the sweet spot, because it takes into consideration the circadian piece of this. And that's what we forget. And in fact, one of the studies we published in pediatrics, we looked at executive functions at baseline in students in Fairfax County. And we found that having the more of an eveningness tendency you had, that was more important in determining deficits in executive functions than how much sleep you got. So it's critical to pay attention to that circadian rhythm piece, because otherwise you won't get as much of a benefit as you ordinarily might. We need to help students manage their schedule so that they have time to sleep. Homework burden, Sarah mentioned that in her introduction. I think that's incredibly important to look at. But you know, we also have to, we're gonna change school start times. We can't undo the good by having athletic practices start at 6 o'clock in the morning or go towards late at night. I think the issue of after school student employment is an important one, certainly for some families. But what we found, so when we worked with Fairfax County, before we even did the study, we worked with the community, and we worked with the school committee, and we did over 50 one-on-one interviews with all the community stakeholders we could think of, including the police, including Parks and Recreation, including the janitors union, including the three teachers unions, including the student organization, including the athletics, because we wanted the community to feel heard and we wanted to get their input and we wanted to have a dialogue. And one of the things that we heard was that employers of adolescents and after school jobs were perfectly willing to move their start of their work an hour later. That didn't turn out to be an issue. So one of the things I would really emphasize to you as a community, as you're going through thinking of making decisions, is that very often, of course, there's a lot of anxiety about this. Change is hard. The status quo feels comfortable. But in many, many communities and districts around the country have successfully made this change. And we interviewed a lot of them. And one of the things they said was the anticipation was far worse than what actually materialized. In one district, all the teachers are going to leave. There's going to be all, and there are problems. I'm not minimizing that in any way. But if you make a thoughtful decision, you make people feel heard, and you give enough time for communities to adjust, that's really critical. That's why I was really glad to see that, California didn't say, next academic year, everybody's got to get in line. That's not realistic, and it's not fair. And then including drowsy driving in driver ed. What can parents do? Know what the signs of deficient sleep are in their teens. Yes, yawning and dozing off and those kinds of things are obvious, but maybe not so obvious is depression or anxiety or poor attention span. Or risk-taking behaviors. Those can be signs of deficient sleep in adolescence as well. And enforcing as much as it's possible to enforce anything with a teenager, appropriate sleep schedule. Think about setting limits on after-school activities and jobs. Keeping track of caffeine use. Monitor drowsy driving. No Z's, no keys. One of the things that parents have control over is allowing their teen to drive. So we did a study a number of years ago in which we took a group of medical residents and we studied them, their performance on a battery of neurocognitive tests, including a driving simulator, when they were rested. Number two condition was when they were post-call, after they had been on call at the hospital. And the third condition was we gave them enough vodka to raise their blood alcohol level to moderately intoxicated. And guess what? They performed as badly or worse in the sleep-deprived condition as they did when they were moderately intoxicated. So that is a level of impairment that parents understand. We all understand, right? So if you say to a parent, would you allow your child to get behind the wheel knowing that they had consumed 3 or 4 beers? No, of course not. But remember that graph I showed you of the peak of car accidents driving themselves to and from school? Providing a sleep-friendly home environment, which means being a good sleep role model yourself, right? That's not necessarily always an easy thing. And making sleep a priority. And I'm always happy to hear from you. That's my email address. I appreciate your attention, and thank you.
Thank you. So I think we'll take some questions. If you want to pass maybe the cards over and towards the front, we will collect those and engage in some Q&A. And while you're doing that, I'm going to kind of kick off with my first question, which relates to where we're defining adolescence in terms of age. And as a follow-up on that, as we think about younger children, I think we hear that puberty is beginning earlier and earlier. So are we seeing the sleep schedule of children earlier and earlier ages being shifted as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. To a certain extent, but you know, the average, so girls go through puberty earlier than boys. And you know, for girls, typically the onset of puberty is around 11. And with boys, it's more like 13 or even, you know, even older. So really we're talking primarily about middle and high school students. Again, you know, we need to understand better what the issues are and the biology is in younger kids. And I was at a pediatric sleep medicine conference this past weekend, and I asked two of my colleagues who probably know more about circadian rhythms in the pediatric population than anyone I can think of. And I said, you know, what do you think about this issue of, you know, elementary school kids? And their first, both of them, first words were, we don't have enough data. You know, so I'm not going to pretend that I can give you a common sense answer that probably between 8 and 9 is a sweet spot for younger kids to start school. Much later than that, you miss, you know, they're up early, they're morning larks, so you're going to miss an opportunity to provide them with, you know, learning in those early hours. But also getting up too early, are they going to have enough time to get adequate sleep? And then there's safety concerns about civil twilight and waiting for the bus in the dark and those kinds of things. So that's a balancing act.
Okay. We'll go to the cards and answer some of the questions. What I'm going to try to do is get to all of the cards. So if there's multiple questions, I may just pick one off of the card. A couple slides back, you talked about the benefit of changing start times. And the question is, can you elaborate more on the magnitude of some of the benefits in terms of the magnitude of what changes or benefits you saw with some of those examples?
In terms of?
I think here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the number, there's, you know, numbers here. You know, my job here was to summarize the data and not, you know, cherry pick every statistic in every study. I'm happy if someone wants to email me. I'm happy to send them the actual articles,
okay.
But that's not my role here.
Are there any studies showing night shift workers have chronic health issues?
Yes, absolutely. people who chronically work night shift are more likely to be obese. They're more likely to have cardiovascular health consequences. They're more likely to have type 2 diabetes. They're more likely to have certain types of cancer. So there definitely is are serious and long-term health consequences. Human beings aren't wired, unfortunately. You know, I mean, our society demands it, but we're not wired to be up at night and to, you know, to sleep during the day. And part of that has to do with, you know, if you're a night shift worker, the rest of the world, you're out of sync with the rest of the world, and you still have to pay bills and do grocery shopping, and, you know, and so we know that shift workers, not only are they misaligned in terms of their circadian rhythms, but they get less sleep because their sleep is interrupted, or they, you know, need to get up to tend to their family and whatnot. So it's kind of a double whammy.
Could you speak more to the importance of REM sleep in learning new tasks? Does more REM sleep help athletic performance as well as academic?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to whether REM sleep improves athletic performance. I mean, I guess if part of athletic performance is tied to learning new tasks and learning how to perform new activities as part of the sports participation, that would make sense. You know, and it's not just REM sleep, but it's also what's called deep or slow wave sleep that's also very important for memory consolidation. So both of those, rather than the lighter stages of sleep, appear to be really critical.
With some of the scientific research, there are a lot of myths about sleep and the idea that if you change start times, students will just stay up later. How, maybe in the communities that you've worked with in other communities, how have you helped them sort of understand the science and break it down to kind of get buy-in from those communities?
It takes talks like this. You know, I travel all around the country giving kind of similar presentations, and I try to tailor them to the needs of the community and where people are in the whole process of thinking about all of this. And that's why I spend a lot of time sort of I front load these talks on the basics of sleep, because I find that that's one of the biggest problems, is that despite the fact that we spend a third of our lives doing it, most of us don't really understand what sleep is all about. And that's, you know, kind of led to this attitude, oh, it's just a waste of time, right? You know, and if you sleep less, that means you're more dedicated and you're harder working. And I mean, that was a huge part of the issue in medical training. It's like a badge of honor the less sleep you got. And so some of this is really making societal changes, you know, on the individual level, but just sort of on the general cultural level, on the way that we look at sleep. You know, sleep is just as important as exercise and nutrition. It's the third pillar of health, and yet, you know, we don't pay enough attention to that. So things are a lot better than they used to be when I first started out in this field, and there's much more awareness of how important sleep is, and part of that has to do with translating the science. But there needs to be a kind of one-on-one dialogue. Like I said, we had over 50 meetings with different constituencies in Fairfax County in order to get those ideas across. So it's not easy.
It's been nearly a decade since the AAP work and the policy statement started in 2010. What has changed in the 10 years since?
Oh, I think, you know, when we first started looking at this issue, there were no study, there were no pre-post studies. The vast majority of studies looked, compared schools that started at an earlier start time versus schools that started at a later start time. And it was really only, we published one of the first studies in 2010 that was actually a pre-post study. So we got baseline data, and then, you know, after the start time change, we measured the same things. And I have to tell you, I was a skeptic. I was a real skeptic at the beginning of all this. And my daughter was actually a student at a independent school in Rhode Island. And the headmaster came to me and said, I want to change the start time, but I'm getting a huge amount of pushback from the faculty, who said, it's not going to make any difference, it's just going to complicate the schedule. And so will you come and talk? And I did. And I said, you know what, let's study this. And I was really skeptical at the time. I remember very vividly having a conversation with the founder of Start School Later, saying, I'm not sure that this is really going to do it. And we did this study at my daughter's school, and not only did I see a child who was much happier and more alert and had time to eat breakfast in the morning, but virtually every single outcome we looked at was highly statistically significantly improved after the start time change. And this was only a half hour start time change, but they went from 8 to 8:30. And that's one of the things that really started to convince me that it's not just how much you shift the start time, it's when you shift it too, that you really have to take into consideration. And so I was really amazed at that. And then subsequently we replicated those same results, not just in a small independent school, but, you know, in the 11th largest school district in the country.
If a community member wants to educate themselves on the specific benefits associated with changing start times, what would you say would be a compelling study that they would go to first?
Well, I would encourage you to go on the website of Start School Later, startschoollater.net. They have virtually every article that you can imagine on this. And there's summaries, but there's also links to the original articles. And I think that that's the best repository of this information in one place. And, you know, they include articles that, you know, were not as positively, you know, maybe some of the outcomes were not as robust as originally hypothesized, and some that, you know, had very positive outcomes. So I think the point here, one of the important points, is that this issue has been looked at by many different research groups, using many different methodologies in many different school districts, and have found essentially the same basic results. Different according to some of the different environments. Some were stronger results than others, but they all point in the same direction. And that's really an important point to keep in mind. That's a strength of this evidence, that it comes from so many different directions and done by so many different groups.
Can I just follow up on that? That was my question. Because I think hitting on the point that you just mentioned about there's so many things out there, which, like, is there a study that you would say is the most compelling so that somebody who's new to this, like going to a repository can be very, very overwhelming for anyone, but where's the first place to start? What would be like the first study to look at?
I mean, I'm a great admirer of Kyla Wahlstrom's work. I think, and she has some new data that's going to be published very soon that I think is really quite compelling. She's a very good researcher. I like to think that our group's work is up there. Very rigorously done. I mean, very rigorous, and published in very high-level journals, so you know, there's some vetting process to that as well. Mary Karskadden, I mentioned earlier, her seminal work on the biology of what happens during an adolescent sleep, I think is absolutely critical. Amy Wolfson is another researcher that has done tremendous work. So it's hard, I don't think there's any one study that I can point to. And that's important because it's not just one study; it's the accumulation of evidence.
What is getting back to sleep? What is the impact of a nap, like a 2-hour nap during the day, versus weekend catch up? Is there any benefit?
Yeah, that's really a good question, and naps can be quite restorative if done at the right time and the right length. So what we will typically recommend is take advantage of that circadian dip in the late afternoon because you're more likely to be able to fall asleep. And we recommend not sleeping longer than a half hour because if you sleep longer than that, you're more likely to go into deep sleep. And if you try to wake up during deep sleep, you may experience what's called sleep inertia, which is that horrible sort of groggy, like, where am I feeling? And like, I just feel worse when I nap. And that's probably because you've napped too long. I will recommend that as a strategy for some of the high school students that come to my clinic and they're absolutely exhausted. And you know, they can't go to bed at 9:30 in order to get up for a 7:30 start time. So, you know, I rather than having them sleep in, you know, for hours and hours later on the weekends, I do sometimes recommend a nap. I mean, I have kids, high school kids, coming in with what's called sleep paralysis, which means that when they wake up in the morning, they can't move. They're awake, but for a period of time, they can't move. That's a symptom of narcolepsy, okay? Narcolepsy is a chronic, lifelong neurological disorder that causes, that it's a brain-based disorder that makes people incredibly sleepy. And these students, just because of chronic sleep loss, have a symptom of narcolepsy. I mean, it just blows me away when I see that in my clinic. And I have so many teens coming in who are depressed, who are anxious, and it's all because they're sleep deprived. So I see it every day in my practice. That's all anecdotal, but it's very powerful and very sad.
This is an interesting one as well about sleep that I had on my mind. Is it an okay practice to supplement with melatonin, either with adults or with kids who can't fall asleep by the time prescribed?
The answer is
over-the-counter melatonin different than actually occurring?
Okay. The answer is no. It's not okay to drug your kids to get them to go to sleep earlier than they're ready to go to sleep to accommodate a start time that's too early. That's, pardon my French, ass backwards. I'm just, you know, that's not okay. We don't know what the long-term effects of melatonin are. Melatonin actually has an impact on pubertal development. And it has, I mean, I think in general, for patients that have insomnia, real insomnia, under supervision, and with controlled circumstances, melatonin can be beneficial in helping students fall asleep. But it should not be used as an antidote to, I mean, that just, ugh. That's not right. even 5 years ago, the amount of melatonin that's being used in kids is astounding to me. Just astounding. And you never give sleep medication without combining it with behavioral interventions, because it's the behavioral interventions that fix things. The drug is a band-aid. And then you asked about over-the-counter. So there was a study that was done in Canada that was published 2 years ago that looked at, I think it was 31 different commercial melatonin products. You know, different brands, different lots within the same brand. And the amount of melatonin in what was supposed to be 5 milligrams ranged from 0 to 20 milligrams. And about 25% of the samples contained serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter that's a precursor of melatonin, that's, you know, just there, and who knows how much it is. So if you're going to use melatonin, go online and purchase what's called pharmaceutical grade melatonin, because that's the kind of melatonin that's used in clinical trials, and you're actually giving the amount that the label says it is. I had a patient today, teenager, who's taking 20 milligrams of melatonin. I never prescribe more than 5 milligrams. But who knows? I have no idea how much he's actually getting. I've had patients come in on 40 milligrams of melatonin. I mean, it's great. It's gotten out of control. And so I think, you know, and it's also, think about the message that, especially you're giving younger kids, like you have to take a, if you can't sleep, you take a pill. And that's not a good message.
These next two questions are kind of related, and they look at elementary, so I'm going to try to combine them because I think you addressed a little bit around information related to elementary students and parents. You had shared that there's really not a lot out there related to elementary kids and sleep. This related question is maybe in your experience in working in other communities. You talked a little bit about the flip, where elementary would go first. Have you seen other models of how districts have approached the elementary schedule if they were moving middle school and high school start times?
Yeah, I mean, in Fairfax County, they didn't move the elementary school start time at all. And you know, that's a bit of a double-edged sword, too, because, you know, some parents, they make, the elementary schools in some communities starts at 9:30. And for a lot of parents, they don't like that. It's too late. You know, they have to hang around until, you know, they're ready to get on the bus. Again, I think there's from a practical, logistical, family lifestyle perspective, probably a start time between 8 and 9 is, you know, is a good range for elementary schools. Do we know if there's harm if they start at 7:30 or they start at 9:30? No, that's where it starts to get murky.
We just have a few more questions, and then I'll conclude. I'm going to expand upon this question a little bit too, because I think we've seen some examples locally as well. But in your experience of high schools changing to later times, we sometimes see them roll back and reverse their decision. The example on this card is related to the 7 Minneapolis high schools that changed in 98. Most of them changed back to be between 8 and 8:15 versus 8:40. We've also seen and heard, I think, locally of some schools that have changed and then reverted back. What are some of the reasons why schools might do that?
I think it's almost always budgetary. The schools that I've talked to and my colleagues around the country have talked to have made the change almost always are very happy from the perspective of the students are better rested, they're more alert, they're, you know, less depressed, whatever, they're more likely to show up for school, you know, all of those things I think make communities feel that it was successful. There are some instances where for budgetary reasons, because of bus, it ends up being largely related to transportation costs. So it's not because these communities aren't happy with the change, but for whatever budgetary reasons they come up with, they may go back. But there really have been very few districts around the country that have done that. For the most part, these school districts have stayed at the change times.
You mentioned change is hard, and families need to, with start time changes, families need to rethink their habits and their practices. And for some, work hours don't change, or there's difficulty with making adjustments. What would be your advice to families who can't simply change their jobs to support a time change?
Well, I think, you know, in part, school districts, you know, in Fairfax County, they expanded daycare availability for parents who couldn't change their work schedules. And you know, there are some realities. That's why it's so critical to allow enough time for families to make those adjustments. Now, you know, when you think about it, it's very common when students go from elementary school to middle school to go from a start time of 9:30 to a start time of 7:30. And no one says boo about that because that's just the way it is, right? And you know, you make those adjustments because that's the expectation. What becomes hard, very understandably, for communities if all of a sudden there's a change. And then you start thinking, you know, how am I? And absolutely, there's real world challenges to this. There's no question about that. And I think school districts can try to assist with some of that. I know, you know, for some families, they rely on the high school student to come home and take care of the younger kids in the afternoon. But then if the, you know, then it's, I mean, either you're going to have daycare in the afternoon or you're going to need daycare in the morning, you know. So it's a trade-off. And certainly, you know, if you give support to families and you provide them with resources in the community and through the school for things like daycare, I think most families can make it work.
Okay. What would you say related to, I think, parents' fear that high school students are going to miss out on after school activities and opportunities if school goes later, fear being that they may be less competitive for colleges that they're applying to?
We've looked at that. We've looked at that in several studies, and there have been other studies by other researchers that have not shown a significant decline in participation in after-school extracurricular activities or athletics. And, you know, athletics, that's a tough one, you know. But it's starting to think creatively. Like maybe you can do whatever taping that you need to do on the bus to the game instead of doing it before school. I mean, doing it before the students get on the bus. Maybe the student athletes get let out a little bit earlier in the afternoon. I think there are adjustments that can be made to accommodate student athletes. Now, there will be certain athletic groups like swim team, for example. That's tough because there's only, or hockey, ice hockey, you know, there's only certain hours that you can practice. And so for that semester, while those students are playing that particular sport, they may get less sleep, unfortunately. But, you know, you also have to, the trade-off there is that there are now studies which show that student athletes are more likely to get injured if they don't sleep enough. So, and less likely to recover from injuries like concussions, for example. So, you know, you really have to take that holistic view. Everybody has their little area, you know, which I totally get. But you know, if you step back and say, really, this is for the health of our students. If you had a toxin in your school, you know, asbestos or whatever, as a parent, you know, you would do anything to remove that, to get that out of the school, to fix the problem. And if you kind of think of it that way, you're really benefiting. And what keeps me up at night, frankly, is this idea that, you know, 6 years worth of chronic sleep loss, deficient sleep, what does that do 20, 30, 40 years down the line? In terms of cardiovascular health or metabolic health or cognitive health. You know, are we setting students up to be at higher risk for Alzheimer's disease? I mean, that's the kind of thing that terrifies me to think about. And you know, to take those kinds of chances with our kids' lives, I think is really have to think long and hard about the trade-offs there.
Thank you. Just a few more. These are actually probably better addressed to me. Is there an opportunity in wellness classes to spend time discussing sleep and its importance? And you can bet that I was furiously taking notes to relay back to Kristen Lotender. I'm not aware of a wellness unit that includes instruction on sleep. But I do think that there is an important place for it, and that was certainly highlighted today. And so thank you for that question. And then another question related to school start times, I think more specific locally, regarding considerations to slightly adjust school start times compared to some of the scenarios. And I think there are a multitude of options that were under consideration, and where we are now is doing some of this conversation and some of this education. And so that's kind of where we are. As it relates to start times, because as you said, it takes time, education, conversation on the community, and so we're not actively pursuing any scenarios at the moment. And this last note card, I think, conveys all of our sentiments, certainly mine. Thank you very much for this educational presentation. Very lucky to have an expert in the field so close to home and who is so gracious in sharing your time with us. We will share this presentation. We have it recorded. Are we able to capture your content, your slides?
Fine. Sure. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Absolutely.
And we want to make sure that we can to share it to those who couldn't be here tonight. And we really appreciate you being here with us and sharing this as part of our parent education series. So thank you.
This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but I can't do it alone. I can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like this, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. and I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled En Esto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.